Hello.
Hi.
The last second wind of the whole year. This is it.
Just the school year, not the year.
Workshops with David Gates begin with questions. From these, you can often get an idea of how things are going to go. Kiersey, he'll say. Choice of two questions. Question one. Do you think this is the right beginning for this story? Uh-oh. And question two, does this story have an ending? There's no need to worry about the middle. He's cut that. The Gates approach can seem brutal at first. When I got back my first story from him last semester, most of the dialogue had been crossed out, and the exposition was peppered with semi-legible insertions and rewrites. The darlings had been killed, and all of their cousins and nephews, too. But what one learns quickly about David Gates is that what looks at first like brutality is really generosity. And this generosity of time, of thought, of spirit, is one of the defining qualities of his work and his personality. His edits and suggestions are not arbitrary. Rather, they are the work of someone, is this too loud, who has gone inside the text, inhabited it, and treated it as his own. This was borne out when we workshopped one of David's stories in progress last semester, complete with his own first round of edits photocopied onto the pages. We tried to give him a tough critique, but he'd already been tougher on himself than we could ever be. The very act of letting an MFA class pull apart an unfinished story was a lesson in itself. It doesn't pay to be self-important or arrogant about your work. Everything can be improved. Over whiskeys at the Union Club, David generously shares his collected wisdom. Why the Beatles are overrated, why it might take 11 years to get your first story published, why we should all read George Jones's autobiography. If you ask for a book recommendation, his eyes will drift to the rerun of a months-old baseball game playing behind the bar, and then he'll turn to you and say, "Have you read Goodbye, My Brother by John Cheever?" Or Emma by Jane Austen? Besides being a world-class talker, editor, and fashion maven, I'm currently modeling the look. He is, of course, a not-bad writer. He's the author of the story collection The Wonders of the Invisible World and the novels Preston Falls and Jernigan, the latter of which was recently featured in the hit online video Bitches in Bookstores. If that doesn't cement your classic status, I don't know what does. For serious, though, those books will rip your heart out. The novels are about difficult, wisecracking men making very bad decisions. I read Preston Falls on my first flight to Missoula and couldn't believe that something could be so wonderfully dark and miserable and funny at the same time. And then, of course, I met the guy who wrote it. The stories are worlds unto themselves. We are thrust into the lives of Ezra Pound-obsessed political activists and Dickens-loving illustrators, and forced to watch as they navigate the relationships and dilemmas of their lives as best they can. The short fiction has appeared in The New Yorker, The Paris Review, Esquire, GQ, Tin House, and Plowshares. His nonfiction appeared in Newsweek for many years when he was a longtime editor and critic, and it's turned up in a lot of other places as well. He's been a Guggenheim Fellow. His books have been finalists for the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Critics Award. Ladies and gentlemen, a writer who is neither a hack nor a fraud, David Gates.
Thank you. I feel kind of fraudulent being up here because Andrew does such a good imitation of me in workshop. He's got the cadence down, he's got the kind of junky demeanor down, it's really good. And he's getting the look. First of all, I'd like to thank the Top Hat. I'd like to thank Noel, Laurel, BJ and Beth. The wonderful bartenders who take such good care of me when they see me descending on them with that desperate look in my eye. Just to make a liar out of everybody, I'm going to read a piece of nonfiction. This is one that I wrote in the year 2000. Yes, I know you. Yeah. Thank you, Judy. Now I'm gonna just read it. It's kind of self-explanatory. Late in the afternoon, on New Year's Eve, walking along a dirt road in upstate New York, I started getting teary-eyed because I was watching the last sunset of the 20th century. And of course, feeling like a sap and a poser for taking to heart anything so arbitrary and meaningless. I stopped near a pond, looked out at the pink water. It was all slipping into the past, the door closing behind it. Ulysses from the wasteland, Les Demoiselles d'Avignon, and those damn Campbell soup cans. Citizen Kane and The Godfather, The Rite of Spring, and Good Golly Miss Molly, and Like a Rolling Stone. Duke, Bird, Elvis, Frank. And the ones I hadn't just revered, but loved. Samuel Beckett, John Coltrane, Hank Williams, Raymond Carver. Like they were gonna be any more dead come midnight. I looked up and saw the last throb of sun wink out, and it came to me that most of all, Jesus, imagine thinking all this shit. You suppose that I had the heebie-jeebies about my own mortality? That most of all, I was saying goodbye to Louis Armstrong. Of all of them, he would have been the keeper. Strange thing to realize, about myself, I mean. Sure, Pops was the most significant figure in the history of American music, the master synthesis of its European and African strains, its highbrow and lowbrow impulses, but I never once took the trouble to go hear him play in person, not because I thought he'd always be around, but because it didn't occur to me. When I was still in high school, I made sure to go hear Coltrane, Monk, and Mingus, the Stanley Brothers, Bo Diddley, for God's sake. But in 1964, Louis Armstrong was the old fuck who sang Hello Dolly and got enough other old fucks into the record stores to knock Can't Buy Me Love off the charts. When he died in the summer of 1971, I doubt I cared one way or the other. At any rate, I don't remember hearing about it. And yet, the first LP I ever bought, I must have been 13 or 14, was Ambassador Satch, performances from Armstrong's 1955 European tour, which I'd ordered on a whim from the Columbia Record Club, the Amazon.com for small town kids in the early 60s. The second was Louis Armstrong and his Hot Five, a dozen of his canonical size from the mid-20s, heebie-jeebies, cornet chop suey, strutting with some barbecue. They sounded ancient, dry, and two-dimensional after the bright, glossy hi-fi of Ambassador Satch, and the rest of the band seemed quaint and feeble. But Lewis's power, daring, and sheer weirdness, which Harold Bloom says is a hallmark of the canonical, hit me as hard as it had hit the first generation to hear him. Pianist Art Hodes, in a 1992 memoir, recalls fans in 1927 carrying Lewis on their shoulders across the dance floor of Chicago's Savoy Ballroom. A 1926 article in the Black Chicago Defender noted that, quote, the greatest jazz cornet player in the country was, quote, drawing many au fait musicians to dreamland nightly to hear him blast out those weird jazzy figures. Some older musicians, on the other hand, as Armstrong's longtime bass player Arvel Shaw once told an interviewer, quote, used to think he was crazy. As late as 1936, Rudy Valli, of all people, felt called upon to defend, quote, that utterly mad, hoarse, inchoate mumble-jumble that is Lewis's singing, and recommended that doubters listen a few times for structure before writing him off as deranged. With the Hot Five, Lewis was the brilliant young modernist bursting out of an old-fashioned New Orleans ensemble. He put together the group, which played only once in public, to make down-home records for Southern blacks in northern cities. In his real life, young Lewis was fronting slick, up-to-the-minute proto-swing dance bands with sax sections squiggling in formation. I wanted to burst out too, from childhood, from family, from the town that kept me safe. I didn't understand until later that the Hot Five recordings were these goddamn monuments, like Whistler's mother with the Gettysburg Address. That would have put me off them, but I knew every note. Only after Armstrong died and could no longer embarrass me with his gospel album, his Disney album, his country album, and above all, his compulsion to please, which I had a little problem with myself. Did I start listening to him again? The revolutionary 30s big band sides, in which he tears apart and reconfigures great popular songs like Stardust and throwaway crap like Sweethearts on Parade, into something strange and noble. The surreally slurred and muttered vocal, always leading up to an operatic aria for trumpet with a soaring high note at the end. The counter-revolutionary small band recordings of the late 40s and 50s, in which he and his all-stars replay and replay the good old good ones. Indiana, Rockin' Chair, Tin Roof Blues, with stately assurance and fiery exuberance. But most of all, the Hot Fives, the Hot Sevens, and the late 20s collaborations with Earl Hines. Not just the drop-dead masterworks, like Potato Head Blues or Weatherbird or West End Blues, whose unaccompanied introduction, yeah, okay, you've been told this before, may be the shapeliest 12 notes in all of jazz. I treasure nearly as much the improvisations in which he gets lost in the heat of the moment, on Ori's Creole trombone, say, or Alligator Crawl, imagining something he can't quite execute, and then having to find his next move after a fluffed note or a graceless phrase. You can actually hear his thinking mind. I avoid only the very late recordings, his lip and lungs shot to shit, his voice a scattering of grainy particles across the vast absence. Nothing left of him but musicianship and belovedness. The Louis Armstrong sings What a Wonderful World, in weary, rapt awareness that he wouldn't be seeing much more of it. The Louis Armstrong you hear in Starbucks. Even so, that leaves about 40 years of music I can't wear out. So I wanted to get to know him. Yeah, well, fine, a little late for that now, but to the extent I could. His centennial was coming up this summer, and I wasn't getting any younger myself. Though Armstrong was actually born on August 4th, 1901, he might well have believed the too-good-to-check birth date of July 4th, 1900, and why shouldn't we? So I started reading up essays, memoirs, the infuriatingly lousy biographies by James Lincoln Collier and Lawrence Berggreen. I visited the Louis Armstrong archives at Queens College, which has 12 linear feet of personal papers, letters, and autobiographical fragments. 2,000 hours of tapes, his record collection. Who'd have thought he'd own Conway Twitty Sings? His suitcases, 5 of his trumpets, 14 mouthpieces, and what turned out to be heartbreakingly more than a lifetime supply of lip salve. And I sought out people who'd seen him up close in his scary prime, like the octogenarian Lionel Hampton, who'd been the drummer when Lewis fronted Les Heights Band in 1930. He never played on records what he could really play, Hamp told me. One night, he played 100 choruses of Tiger Rag, and every one of them was different. He would hit 50 high Fs in a row, and I would count them out for him aloud. 1, 2, 3, oh, people like that. Clarinetist and marijuana dealer Mez Mezro's generally unreliable 1946 memoir, Really the Blues, has a few glimpses of the preternatural young Armstrong that I'd trust absolutely. Quote, I would sit there watching him handle his razor, sliding it along with such rhythm and grace you could feel each individual hair being cut. The way he shaved put me in mind of the time Lewis was blowing and I brushed up against him by accident, and goddamn if I didn't feel his whole body vibrating like one of those electric testing machines in the penny arcade that tell how many volts your frame can stand. They say it was magical to be around him. Now I wish I could have been. He always pronounced his name Lewis, by the way, so now I try to, though it still feels like a didactic affectation like Nabokov or Lead Belly. Damned if you do, damned if you don't. He must have been a piece of work. With all the money he made, he chose to live in a middle-class neighborhood in Queens, in a modest, verging on drab row house he called high-powered and distinctive-looking. He smoked pot most of his life. Back in the 30s, he'd have reefers put on his orchestra's music stands. And in the 1950s, his manager, Joe Glazer, stopped him from publishing his effusions on the subject. Quote, a thousand times better than whiskey. Relaxes your nerves, great for cleanliness. He also evangelized for an herbal laxative called Swiss Chris, and had thousands of cards printed up with a photo of himself, pants down, on the toilet, and the slogan, "Leave it all behind ya." Though he opened and closed his shows with "When It's Sleepy Time Down South," that cringe-inducing pastiche of plantation imagery, he canceled a State Department-sponsored tour of the Soviet Union after the 1957 Little Rock School desegregation crisis, saying President Eisenhower had no guts and the government could go to hell. Better still, when Nixon invited him to the White House in 1969, he said, "Fuck that shit." He left himself wide open for psycho-schmico theorizing. 5 decades worth of recordings, including 52 versions of Basin Street Blues, 8 or 10,000 performances, how anal expulsive of him. Was he profoundly angry about race? Sure, sometimes. Did his eagerness to please white audiences mean he turned that rage inward? He seems to have been too sane for that. Dizzy Gillespie, who became his friend late in life, once wrote that, quote, "What I considered Pop's grinning in the face of racism was his absolute refusal to let anything, even anger about racism, steal the joy from his life and erase his fantastic smile." James Lincoln Collier reads Armstrong as, quote, "A man afflicted with a sense of his own worthlessness, which he tried to ease by, quote, playing and singing and smiling and mugging and soaking up the healing applause, which for a moment pushed away the feeling that nobody liked him, that he was basically no good." Yeah, so? Every performing artist, and I mean writers too, I mean me, surely has issues about this stuff, rebel outlaws included. Nobody who's needy enough to put work out there for public adulation should get on Lewis's case about his mugging. Anyway, for a wretch with no feelings of self-worth, Armstrong certainly radiated and obviously experienced boundless joy. He seemed gloriously unashamed of his many pleasures, from food, he always described it in letters as delicious, to sex, licit and illicit, to excretion. Joe Blazer managed to suppress Lewis's brief for marijuana, but preserved letters like this for posterity. Quote, "Every night we wailed. I mean, I really grind in that cunt. I could feel it just as good as when I struck oil." God knows what he meant. "All the money in the world couldn't make me any happier than I am right now this minute. Why? Because I've just come from the bathroom taking a good shit." He wasn't a guy who held much back. If you visited his dressing room, you'd find him holding court wearing only a towel wrapped around his head, and undershorts if you were lucky. Louis Armstrong probably had no idea how bizarre he was. Especially considering the amount of dope he smoked, he navigated supremely well through the tunes he played and the times he lived in. But his richly complicated inner life led him to apprehend the outer world in unpredictable ways. I'd always been baffled by his wacky taste in music. The same guy who in the early 50s had Barney Bigard, Jack Teagarden, Earl Hines, and Cozy Cole in his rightly named All-Stars also truly admired Guy Lombardo. He wanted his 30s orchestras to sound like the Royal Canadians, and did they ever. He rhapsodized over the ghastliest pop singers, as you'll see shortly, and the schlockiest songs. The best explanation I know comes from the French jazz critic Hughes Panassier, whom Armstrong befriended during a 1934 sojourn in Paris. Quote, "One day I was with him in his apartment on Rue de Tour d'Auvergne," Panassier wrote. "Suddenly somebody in the courtyard below began to sing an atrocious sentimental song. Immediately, Lewis went to the window, absorbed in what he was hearing, and began to sing. You felt that the value of the song did not mean very much to him. The ear had heard notes, and that was enough to arouse from deep inside of him a whole world of music that was never completely dormant." Though his particular genius was for music, Lewis's creative activity was promiscuous and ceaseless. On a 1932 passport application, he unaccountably identified himself as an actor and musician. Sure enough, by the end of his life, he had appeared in 23 feature films. He wrote compulsively. He began traveling with a typewriter in 1922 when he came up from New Orleans to join King Oliver's band in Chicago. His letters, periodically spiced with such shy-making asides as tee-hee and kind of cute, and generally signed Red Beans and Rice Liures, sometimes run for more than 10 single-spaced pages. He also wrote several long memoirs, just one, the copy-edited but unghosted Satchmo, My Life in New Orleans, was published in his lifetime. Observations of his neighborhood in Queens, and homemade erotica with such titles as Tortures of Love, and passages such as Moving the Plump Thighs Apart, he closely examined the delicious full-lipped cunt. The Louis Armstrong Archives has 650 boxes of reel-to-reel tapes he recorded. Some just put together songs he dug from commercial releases. Everything from Edith Piaf, French singer, to bop music. But many others, hundreds of hours, are uncanny freeform creations in which Louis plays along with records, leaves the machine running during conversations around the house, and tells stories and dirty jokes. And he decorated most of the boxes with postmodern looking collages, words and phrases snipped from newspapers and magazines, and alarmingly recontextualized photos, mostly of himself. Well, you know my hobby, one of them anyway, is using a lot of Scotch tape, he wrote to a friend in 1953. My hobby is to pick out the different things during what I read and piece them together, making a little story of my own. Whatever he would have called these tapes, another hobby, surely, it's not a stretch to think of them as some sort of outsider conceptual art. Michael Cogswell, director of the archives, steered me to one he thought would give me their flavor, a 1956 letter to Louis's old friend Panassier, whom he calls Panassi, and his companion Madeleine Gauthier. It begins with Louis coughing, you wonder, and in the background, a sub-Mario Lanzoid Italian singer named Ray Martino, Louis calls him a wonderful artist, belting out Stranger in Paradise, Louis to his wife. Hey, Lucille. She's in the living room looking at Arthur Godfrey and the Talent Scouts. Some little chick come up from New Orleans on the program. She sang Mobile. She was good. Louis, what is that thing I wear instead of a vest? Cummerbund. Come here and say that, because that sounds nasty to me. It's a cummerbund. Now that's what I call a vest. That's what you call a vest. What is a cummerbund? It's a waistband. It goes right around your waist. Oh, well, how do you say it in French? Darling, my French is not that good. We'll ask Madeleine. How do you say it in French, Madeleine? Cummerbund. Now don't spell it wrong. I'm talking about a vest. Well, in my language, I effervesce. Louis talks about the recent filming of High Society with Bing Crosby, Grace Kelly, and Frank Sinatra, and about which of the all-stars was the biggest Uncle Tom, then returns to the subject of Ray Martino, whom he'd heard in Milan. He tears up the house. He's a living aspirin. Dig this. Martino finishes singing Madame Je Vous Aime Beaucoup, and Louis, realizing he'd talked all through it, gets up and puts on the song again. But this time, after the vocal, he picks up his trumpet and plays a solo on top of the violins. A little out of tune with the record, but quintessential Armstrong. Long phrases balanced against short, melodic lines cavalierly trespassing across the bar lines. Melodic ideas cavalierly trespassing across the bar lines. Artful use of silence, a satisfyingly symmetrical structure built out of small asymmetries. Meantime, there's a phone call. Just as if he were in the studio, he stops when the singer begins again and holds his peace until the song's over.
How do you like him? Great little cat, isn't he?
Lucille, which way is the plug?
Yes, that was Ray Martin doing that beautiful singing.
Where's the plug?
The plug's over there. Oh, flash, 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 says Walter Winchell. Speaking of Ray Martino, a call came in on the phone, and it was Cozy Coles, and I'm trying to get Lucille to hook up the phone in the den so Cozy can talk to Madeline and Panassi and all the cats that loves him so well. So Cozy's gonna come up in a minute, and this den here looks like a whorehouse on Christmas morning. It ain't but two on us, and it looks like we're crowding out this whole little house here. Wait a while. Hello? What the hello? Cozy!
Voice of Cozy Cole through static.
He's been the master for years. It does me all the good in the world just to talk with him because he inspires me. He's talking backwards. Thank you, Thomas Cozy Coles. Thank you.
He still has Tomming on his mind. The All-Stars' former drummer's real first name was William.
These are people who love you, said those words that you said those words to. Cozy, it's been nice talking to you, Daddy. Isn't that a coincidence, old Cozy Cole call up at the same time? I was talking to y'all, my man.
Silence. Ben Lewis's 1955 hit recording of Mac the Knife begins to play. Halfway through it, he realizes the tape's running out and cuts the song off.
We shall now continue on the other side with Mac the Knife. Part two coming up. Satchmo speaking to his dear friends Panassi and Madeline.
So is this the sort of thing I was after in all the books and reminiscences? The true stream of Louis Armstrong's consciousness at last? A privileged glimpse of his secret self? Or is it just another performance for dear friends, of course, and we all know what a difference that makes in how much we reveal? With a little domestic audio verite thrown in, or would this distinction have made any sense to him? The inmost Louis Armstrong, he said so himself, as you'll hear, is in his music. It's way down below the words. Even when he sang, those were malleable, even dispensable, just another part of the musical texture. In the continually exfoliating patterns and structures, in the flow of thoughts, emotions, calculations, risks, intuitive leaps. In those places where you hear him worrying a short phrase over and over like a terrier shaking a rat, or holding a single note and basking in his own golden tone. And he lived, really, just to perform this ultimate self-exposure again and again and again. Before his last gig at the Waldorf Astoria in March 1971, he sat clutching his trumpet, staring at the ceiling, listening to his physician tell him the obvious. He was frail, short of breath, he had congestive heart failure. He could die on stage.
Doctor, Lewis finally said, you don't understand. My whole life, my whole soul, my whole spirit is to blow this horn.
And this most secret act of self-communion needed to be offered up in an open ceremony in front of everyone.
My people are waiting for me, he told the doctor. I cannot let them down.
Nobody who lives by and for writing, that is, parading of private consciousness for public consumption, could pretend not to know what he was talking about. Him in that Manhattan hotel room on his last go-round, and me on that country road at sunset. I knew that his gifts and his works, his joys and his sorrows, made mine look piddling, but didn't we both have the same needy, pushy compulsiveness, and weren't we both heading into the same dark? He'd been my earliest mentor, I hadn't even realized. And one of the century's great masters, and now he was gone, and the century was just about down to nothing. If I said I wept over Louis Armstrong, for God's sake, would you believe me? Thank you.